Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Engine. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Cole Hernaday.
Get off my lawn.
And Chris Casso.
I have no other lawn to go to.
Please, sir. Please, sir.
May I have some more turf?
I'll turf you, buddy.
Hey, how's everybody doing today?
Doing good.
Wonderful. Wanted to meet your excitement.
More charming than our own. Good.
So, hey, let's just start off, shall we? Now, this is a topic that Chris Casso, you sent to me with a list. It's what are some What If and Elseworld comics, and what are some we would recommend? Now, first off, explain to me. I guess if we are also turning this into an explain to Ben moment, we haven't done one of those in a while. What is a What If and Elseworld comic?
So they used to be called in the Silver Age imaginary tales. Mm-hmm. And that's when they would tell something out of continuity, something just really weird. And they could just go back and be like, well, wasn't that weird? Now back to the normal show. Mm-hmm. But Marvel had What If, and it was hosted by Uatu, the Watcher. He watched the Earth, but it turns out he has a great television, and he can tune into all these alternate realities. And so you would get a story, an issue, where it's like, what if Punisher became Venom? What if Wolverine became the Vampire King? What if blah, 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 blah. And they went on for quite some time. And then DC, on the other hand, introduced the Elseworlds. And same concept, what if it's just another reality? But they made their Elseworlds thicker. They were either a miniseries or a big, fat comic special or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of like a nice showcase for different creative teams who normally wouldn't do a core story, and or maybe they got like a unique creator that, you know, didn't want to do a run of Superman, but it's like, I want to really tell you the story about Superman landing in communist Russia. And that's one of the more popular stories, Superman Red Sun.
What Chris is talking about, just a little bit, there were like four volumes of What If, or two?
I want to say there were three, and then there was a bunch of like small runs. Sure. Throughout the late 90s, early 2000s.
I only really cared about the original volume, which was 77 to 84. Mm. And I would pick them up sporadically, and as luck would have it, I was actually cleaning those out this weekend.
Nice.
But I picked up some, and some were really individual issues, were very successful, others were not. But my main takeaway about What If is that it had the suspicious way of reinscribing the Marvel Universe status quo. That is to say, they would introduce a concept that would challenge, you know, let's say Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four, or what if the brain of the Hulk, what if the Hulk had the brain of Bruce Banner, or what if the Avengers had been formed in World War II, and all this kind of cool things. Some really, actually really fun ideas, but because they deviated from the stories we're familiar with, they frequently ended in tragedy.
Almost always.
Yeah, because, you know, the way that we've set up the norm for Marvel Universe, that's the only healthy way to exist. And that's kind of what they were telling you with What If. But if you look at how storytelling has evolved at Marvel Comics, many of those What If stories have now, those ideas have become canon.
Yes.
We have seen the Hulk had the brain of Bruce Banner significantly and through a long period of time. One of my all-time favorites is actually number 10, What If Jane Foster Had Found the Hammer of Thor? What? You know, which back in 1978 or so, that was a pretty challenging idea. And by the by, she didn't go by Thor. Her name was Thoris. Rhymes with Doris.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a bunch of these ideas. And the other one was like, what if the Avengers had fought evil in the 1950s? And it's these, and they, I can't remember, it was Kurt Busiek and somebody else.
Avengers Forever, the Carlos Pacheco stuff you're talking about?
Yeah, but a lot of these characters are the 50s characters, like Marvel Boy and Namora, who became the Agents of Atlas later.
Yeah.
So these are all ideas that were, you know, maybe unintentionally tested out 20, 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and then proved to be actually kind of fun ideas, particularly having Thor be a gender neutral name and a female character. But the other thing that about Elseworlds was that when Elseworlds started out, they came to being in during Batmania. In the late 80s. So for a long time, your Elseworlds stories were only Batman stories. It was like, it surprised me when the first because you had things like Gotham by Gaslight, I am just tripping on my
Gaslight.
Gotham by Gaslight, Holy Terror, Brightest Night, where Batman is...
Green Lantern.
What's the one where Batman is Superman? Or Kal-El is...
Oh, I always flip that one.
Yeah.
I always think that's the light one.
Right.
So I can't remember what that one's called.
But then there were interesting things like the Golden Age, which we talk about on occasion, which is kind of an Elseworlds story, but not, because it's a story of the World War II characters, but you get to learn things about them that you never had before.
Yeah. I think that one was officially considered Elseworlds at a certain point.
Like, yeah,
they put
no,
the stamp on
was.
It. Yeah. The sorry, I got kind of flipped on my Elseworlds and my what ifs.
Yeah, it's easy to do.
You were saying the Superman one that was really popular. That one is called Red Sun.
Red Sun.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And much to Chris's chagrin, that one's by Mark Millar, and that happens to be one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, there's a great idea there, but it still has most of the things I hate about him in it. There's another one. The most common thing with Superman is, what if he just landed somewhere else? And there was Superman the Dark Side, which is the rocket lands on Apocalypse and he's raised by Darkseid.
Right.
And he's like a total evil, horrible person. There's a really great one that flips it where Earth is dying and they send a rocket that lands on Krypton. Mm-hmm. And Superman grows up, and he grows up weaker under the gravity of Krypton, and then the Green Lantern ring finds him. So you just kind of get this mixed mashing of weird
Steve
ideas. I think so. That may have been Gerber, and I think Doug LaWheatley did the art or something like that. But now for What If, I have a harder time with What Ifs because most of them are throwaway stories to me.
Right.
And especially like that second series, the second and third ones, the ones that are mostly in the 90s, they're kind of trash most of them.
Terrible.
The last one ever published was great though because it was What If... nobody could escape the secret war planet. Mm-hmm. And they basically, it's like 25 years later and they're like, well, let's just shack up with each other. And so all their children, their mixed children, become like super powered individuals that want to leave the planet. And you get like great things like, Captain America shacked up with Rogue and their daughter, has the shield, Rogue's powers, and can actually lift Thor's hammer. And then Dr. Doom shacked up with the Enchantress and has a little horrible child. But the Enchantress also shacked up with Thor. So the son of Thor and the son of Dr. Doom are stepbrothers. There's just a lot of fun stuff like that. It was written by Jay Ferber, who went on to do like tons of Image stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
For... I have a very short list of Elseworlds that I enjoyed. I mentioned some of them already, but there's Batman Gotham by Gaslight, which is one of the first ones, and I think one of the best, because it's Mike Mignola, and it's Batman in Victorian London. There's Golden Age, James Robinson, Paul Smith, Batman Holy Terror, where Batman is rebelling against a world dominated by the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Kingdom Come by Mark Waid and Alex Ross. Superman Red Sun, we were talking about. But one of my favorites is actually Wonder Woman Amazonia. Have you
Gerber?
Guys ever read that one?
That was Gerber.
Bill Messner-Lobes and Phil Winslade.
Winslade, okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Where it's Wonder Woman in Victorian London, kind of steampunky, which I'm not particularly fond of. But Winslade's artwork is lovely, and it's all about her, being essentially a superpowered suffragette in a lot of ways, fighting misogyny and imperialism. But it is one of my favorites. And, of course, I used to be a big fan of Alan Davis, so the Justice League The Nail was... And there were two of those.
Yeah, and we've talked about those on this podcast. I'm surprised you didn't mention the Doom that came to Gotham.
I don't think it's as, I think it's overrated. About that point, I was really tired of Lovecraft getting incorporated into things, and I thought it was I didn't feel like as strong as it could be. Yeah. It wasn't as strong as Gotham by Gaslight.
Gaslight.
I'll say.
Why did you like it though?
Well, Troy Nixie did the art, and they did some fun melding. So like the Cold Air story was worked with Mr. Freeze. Yeah. And Ra's al Ghul was the madman trying to call mm-hmm. the demons down. So it did. It chose some of the right characters to mix match with the Lovecraft mythos.
Maybe I need to go back and reread it.
The one I was just going to mention as my favorite was Detective 27. It was written by Michael Uslan, who was the screenwriter for the first Batman movie. And it basically followed the idea of it's Golden Age Batman, and when he was in the study thinking about, like, oh, criminals are a cowardly and superstitious lot, so what will I do to strike fear in them? The door or the window that the bat flew through was actually reinforced, and the bat just died of hitting the door. and he just looks at the door and is like, stupid bird. And he gets actually inducted into a secret society of detectives who go by numbers. And so Alfred was Detective 26, mm-hmm. and Bruce gets to become Detective 27, which is the first issue of his first appearance.
Right.
And they deal with a secret conspiracy that's been around since the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And it's just a really weird story that merged like Golden Age DC with actual history. Like Babe Ruth shows up, and then like random Golden Age villains show up. So it's, you don't have to know any of it, but it's a lot of fun.
Was this like a one-shot issue, or was
novel.
It a mini? Okay, so it was released as just a book.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just one big book.
Is it something that's still in print?
Last time I checked, it wasn't.
Okay.
So I really wish they would bring it back, but there's no reason to right now.
Yeah.
Maybe if they ever hired Michael Uslan again, they'd do that as like a goodwill. Like, look at this. We still remember you. But yeah, I highly recommend that if you just stumble across it. It's one of my favorite Batman stories, period. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Are these books, these What Ifs and Elseworlds, are they considered part of continuity?
Generally not until they are.
Yep.
Yep.
So, for example, Kingdom Come, which Cole mentioned, there's a lot of things that there was such a well-received story, and a lot of people loved it. The DC teased that that would be the actual future, and they would do things like, oh, that character you heard about, he just showed up in this new issue of Superman.
Right.
Or the Red Arrow was a character, like, we just made that a real character, you know? So
Red Robin. And, Magog, they brought that whole bad guy into the storyline in JSA.
So what they did is when they finally brought back the multiverse at the end of the 52-week series, the 52, they designated, like, oh, yeah, Earth the 7 is the Kingdom Come universe. Mm-hmm. And the vampire universe from that one Elseworld story, that's Earth, like, 17 or something.
Well, it's actually, that was three Elseworld story, the Blood Rain Batman.
Blood Rain Batman, yeah.
Which got exhausting, but I didn't bring that up because it did get exhausting, but it is Kelly Jones's artwork, and and Batman is a vampire.
So a lot of them technically, yes, are in continuity because they're just different planets you can visit.
Yeah.
What if not? Well, same thing with What If, because every Earth universe has a designation, and I can't remember where the main Marvel 616.
Mm-hmm.
They will mention, like, oh, yeah, Earth 7545, whatever. And it's like, that was a specific issue. Yes.
Okay.
There was, what's the Warren Ellis one from Marvel?
Ruins.
Not Ruins. Oh. There's the one where Fin Fang Foom shows up in it, and it's silly, and there's Machine
Next
Man.
Wave.
Next Wave. So Next Wave was supposed to be an Elseworld sort of story, but Marvel, for some reason, says that a lot of that stuff's canon, but it's kind of weird. So that's one of those that was just like Warren Ellis did a story, and it was done.
Al Ewing fixed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He figured it out.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah. I was pretty intrigued looking back on the 70s What Ifs of all the storylines that, or the story ideas that actually have become canon as a result.
Yeah.
Decades after the fact. And I kind of attribute that to just being a dilution of ideas, you know, and it's like, hey, why don't we take this screwball idea that we had as a What If story back in the day and make it happen?
Cool. Do you have any favorites, Nicole?
Because we did a lot of talking.
I like this couple issues of What If Deadpool comics. There's one where Deadpool became Galactus's herald, and he gets called up, and he thinks Galactus is pretty gangster, that he eats like planets and stuff like that. So it's just silly, and it doesn't really matter, but it's super fun. I liked a lot of the Secret War stuff, which I don't know if it would count towards Elseworlds, because it was like we had a continuity and then it became Battle World, but then it's not Battle World. Now it's back to being something. So none of those stories are currently in continuity, but maybe they are. Right. So I don't know.
And isn't Logan technically Once Upon a Time? Was
I mean,
Old Man Logan.
And there were people who were kind of plucked out of these things and put into 616. So, but I really liked the Inferno series. I had reviewed that a long time ago when you were in the treasuries of the Secret Wars things that Chris was doing. And DC Bombshells was one that I really liked, but the art kept flip-flopping. That one is where all the women of the DC universe who were the pinup model that you might have seen, they are all in like the 1940s and existing all together. Mm-hmm. And that's just its own sort of thing. So
cool.
I forgot about Neil Gaiman's 1602.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
Which actually was a terrible disappointment.
I think most people forgot about that.
Yeah. but it was the Marvel Universe set back in the 1600s. Okay. And it was, and they assured us this was not a what if story. This was actual continuity.
I'm convinced that there was something wrong that happened at the end, that there was an editorial flip-flop, because there was a really weird turn of story in that one.
Yeah.
So I feel that we missed something good there.
I agree.
It's continuity, unless people don't like it, in which case we're going to forget it ever happened.
Well, and it's also Neil Gaiman, so there was a time where he wrote some stuff for Marvel that just was not... The Eternals series was just not up to his creative par. And that was one of them.
It was the wrong playground for him.
I concur. You need to go back to DC Vertigo with Karen Berger and let everybody else leave him alone and tell good Neil Gaiman stories. We miss you, Neil Gaiman. Come back.
All right. Any final words on What Ifs and Elseworlds?
Even the bad ones are worth checking out.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, they're fun to just see different ideas happen.
Yeah.
You know, and they're usually not that expensive. And most of the Elseworlds are being reprinted in like the Elseworld Batman specials. So relatively easy to find and worth your time.
Yep. Cool. All right. Thank you all. So let's move on to our next topic. And this, we're going to talk about fridging. And this is something that's come up before. In fact, rather recently we talked about it. But also not so recently, back in our early days, we had a discussion about fridging characters. And so let's revisit it. And first off, let's explain what fridging is and its origins.
So did you,
either one of us.
Either one. You go ahead.
Okay. So the term came from the Green Lantern number 54 that was published in 1994, where Green Lantern Kyle Rayner's girlfriend was killed and stuffed in a fridge.
Okay.
And Gail Simone coined the phrase to as a symbol of using women as a plot device to move along a male character's storyline. And that's where the term fridging characters come from. But it's not necessarily just based on gender, because we have seen it in happen to men as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we were just a couple episodes talking about the Earth 2 series, and they established that that version of Green Lantern was gay, but they immediately killed his husband, like, within the first issue.
Yeah.
So at that point, you're just you fridged him.
They fridged him. They fridged him, yeah.
It's just like, you know, that makes him suddenly feel a sense of heroism or sacrifice or something. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, but now it doesn't really matter that you made him gay, you know?
Yeah, because now he's alone.
He's got no relationship.
There's nothing to...
That was... I remember picking up that issue to read that, excited for what they were going to do, and they immediately... sexually neutralized that character instantly, and they did in this violent and ugly way.
The other thing too is that they were promoting this and celebrating that they were going to do this.
Yes,
that they were going to say that Alan Scott was gay, and that's what they did with it.
Like, we're being super progressive,
and then they killed his lover.
Right.
So
now I do believe they resurrected.
Made him celibate.
Yeah. I do believe they resurrected the brother at some or the lover at some point, but it took a while. So at that point, we kind of stopped caring.
Right.
But yeah, it's a very consistent trope. It's just that the consistency with it happening to women is it just happens so much more often, and that's where Gail Simone was just like, come on,
yeah,
and started noting all of them down.
Where the sexy lamp thing came from as well, where you could replace any woman as like a lamp? And I think that's a Kelly Sue DeConnick thing.
I think so.
Where if the lamp has as much characterization, like if you use that characterization, it doesn't matter if it's a lamp or a woman or a telephone pole or whatever, like it's bad characterization. It's like another thing of that where they're just used kind of as a plot device.
Yeah, an issue not isolated to comics. It's spread across all pop culture and media. So what are some other examples of fridging?
Oh, Gwen Stacy would probably be one of the biggest ones.
Yeah.
She was murdered by the Green Goblin. This is the tricky. There's a line for me that is, it can go either way, where it's just like, she'd been around for quite a while too, and it was a huge dramatic moment, and I almost don't want to categorize it. It can be categorized. It's kind of weird for me. I was rereading the Garth Ennis's The Boys, and there's a few instances of like instant fridging on that one. But at the same time, it's just like, well, it's not like I really wanted to read that character. The whole point is there's a cast of damaged characters, so they wanted to show you somebody who was immediately damaged. So it's just like, And I've read plenty of books that Garth Ennis did that were like anti-fridging, where in Preacher, he made it a point that the main character was constantly trying to like put his girlfriend in the corner so she'd be out of the way of danger, and she would let him have it when that happened.
Yep.
So it's just like, so he's aware of like, that's a weak thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there are times where, I'm not going to say it needs to happen, but there are times where a death does need to happen, and it maybe just happens to be a woman.
We've been taught that that's the inciting incident for heroes.
Yes.
Journey.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and the inciting, and for in the Golden Age, they were parental, you know, Bruce Wayne losing his parents.
Uncle Ben.
Sorry, that shouldn't be funny, but I just
Krypton.
Think Krypton of Uncle exploding. Ben Wayne, Howard the Duck.
You know, and it's in the past. It's in the character's distant past that sets their motivation forward. But then you have something like Kyle Rayner's girlfriend, where he's already become a superhero. He's already got the green. He's already got the ring. Yet he's just apparently the editorial. Brains don't think he's well motivated enough to be passionate about his heroism, so he's got to suffer some unforeseen tragedy, like having Major Disaster cram his girlfriend in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
And it's forced, and it's insulting, yes, and it's ugly.
Yeah, it's very, very forced in those cases, so that's where it's... I don't want to say there's good fridging and bad fridging. I just want to say bad deaths are fridging more often than not.
Right.
There was a more recent example of that too, of Barry Allen's mother.
Mm-hmm.
With the rebirth and then bringing back the first rebirth of Barry Allen. They added that thing of like, oh, his mother was murdered, and that was the mystery that's motivated him to be a forensic scientist. And they put that into the TV show, and it's just sort of like, I really like the idea of a hero just being a nice guy.
Well, I gotta tell you though, I just got done watching the first season. I haven't moved on to two or three, but I actually was taken by that story. There was not a lot that was keeping me engaged, particularly the pretty people CW romance, teen romances of those shows.
Yeah.
But I cared about that plot, and I wanted to see because I know how it was going to roll, but I wanted to see how it unraveled. Because Lord knows I didn't care about their sicky sweet romances and chest pounding and
so it was well.
Boy, the gal that plays. the girlfriend.
He's had a couple.
No, the main girlfriend,
Iris,
the wife, Iris.
Iris,
the woman who plays Iris. I just want to push her through a wall. She is so awful. I want to fridge her.
So there's
written poorly. She's a terrible actor. I can't stand watching her.
So there's an instance of a fairly well crafted loss of a main character, or not a main character, but of a parental figure of a woman. And so it's like, so it's a trope. And sometimes you need the trope in place to tell a good story.
Right.
So as long as it can be crafted, I'm like, okay, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the major disaster refrigerator one is the one that's just like, did he really even have to do it that way?
I remember reading it being thinking, this is just stupid and brutal and unnecessary.
Yeah.
You know?
Is it weird that my brain is just like, did he, they had to empty everything out of the fridge, right. Take the shelves off. Like, there's just a level of commitment here that I'm thinking like, I don't know. Is it worth it?
She's all squished. She squished her into a little ball of bones. And
I will say if there's a redeeming thing to happen from that, it's that later on during Blackest Night, Kyle Rayner was confronted by a Black Lantern refrigerator.
Yep.
All right.
He never got to see exactly what's in it, but the moment it showed up, I was like, I want that action figure.
Mm. you hear that, people? Evil black refrigerators.
Yes. Yes. We've come so far.
So, yeah. So when it's forced, it's a problem.
Right.
Yes. When it's not furthering plot, it's a problem. Like,
is this something that, like, when you're reading comic and there's a character death, does your brain automatically sort of just get taken out of the story and you're like, is this an instance of fridging? Is it relevant?
No, not
is it,
for
is,
me.
Do I care?
It's more incompetence is my first thing.
It depends on the book because Invincible, the Image series Invincible, there's a lot of deaths that happen in there and I stopped caring really quick. And Savage Dragon made me not care about a single character because it wanted to give you the idea, no one's safe. And the thing is, when no one's safe, the turnover is so fast that you're just like, I can't invest.
Walking Dead.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
I could invest in that. There's a characterization happening in Game of Thrones.
I had an investment in Walking Dead, but like 7 to Eternity... you get a death pretty early on, but you get no characterization behind any of the characters, really. So it's like, I get that this is supposed to be a motivation, but I don't care.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then when we get to Book Report, let's talk about Saga, because that was one of the things I wanted to talk about of the latest volume of Saga.
Oh, I haven't read that.
Okay. Anybody else?
Never mind.
I read most of it.
All right, well, any final thoughts on fridging friends? Mm. Not fridging friends, but fridging, comma.
Don't fridge your friends.
Yeah. Don't fridge your friends.
Yeah.
If so, get a spacious refrigerator.
Yeah.
Don't try with fridging friends.
A walk-in. Yes.
A walk-in. Yes.
Get a tall one.
Yeah. All right, I think we're done with that topic anyway. Let's move on to
come
Book
back
Report.
To it in a year.
Okay, we'll come back to it in a year. And let's start with Cole Hornaday.
I'm not going to talk about Saga. I'll wait till next episode. so I want to talk about the comic book I read was Star Wars Screaming Citadel. It's a 5-part miniseries written by Kieran Gillen and drawn by Marco Cicchetto. This kind of takes place between storylines in the regular Star Wars comic, but also I think it probably Chris, do you know, are these going to overlap with like the Dr. Aphra series and the main Star Wars
yes.
title?
Yeah, okay. This is just a one shot, and then you've got to get Aphra and the doc and the main Star Wars.
Okay, so this is the standalone book, and parts 1 or 4 through 5 are actually in the other series.
It's similar to Vader Down, where Vader Down had a one shot, and then it went into Star Wars and Vader for the next couple issues.
Okay, yeah, that's unfortunate. I'm not going to review this one now.
That's it. I'm done.
Because one of the things I've appreciated about the Star Wars books is that I don't get fatigued, or I've not been too fatigued by crossover stuff. Because I don't read the Dr. Aphra title, but I did read the Vader Down, and I did read the Darth Vader book, because I was intrigued with how they were expanding continuity. Case in point was, like, you know, the evil astromech robot BT-1 and 000. But just to give you a little overview of what the story is, Dr. Aphra has a Jedi device that holds some type of recorded consciousness of a Force user, and she hooks up with Luke on a backwater planet, and they go to the Screaming Citadel that is run by some ancient, powerful empress-type person who reads like the Queen of Fairy, because all these aliens, all these different races are showing up with a tribute because they need a favor from her, and she shows up like once a year, comes out of hiding, and offers people a favor with the proper tribute. And frankly, I think she's just kind of a space vampire character. there's not a lot of originality to the storyline, but the artwork is beautiful. And also, one of the things I was appreciating as I read this was the consistency of design that we are now seeing in Star Wars stories, because we have enough movies and enough comic books that sort of dictate even consistent fashion design and architectural design and spaceships, and you can and that's thanks to a lot of things: video games, board games, all that kind of stuff. And I was really digging on that and appreciating that, because it can now be far more of a successful immersion process and enjoying a story than it was when I was a kid, because we had a couple of the movies and we had the Marvel comic books that were not even remotely consistent in their design or even in their artwork. But now we do have all these things, and it's kind of fun. And yeah, this book is really fun. Mayhap I shouldn't let it, the fact that I just discovered that it's a crossover with the other titles that I don't read, to get in my way.
Well, but now you'll just have to read them.
I will just have to read them, or I'll borrow them from someone else. But I did enjoy it, and you get to see Luke in this really kind of sweet Victorian frock coat and boots, and he looks pretty hot. And of course, I like these evil robots. I like the evil sadistic robots that are the analogs to R2-D2 and C-3PO.
The good thing is they do collect those in one collection. Uh-huh. So like the Vader Down, it was just trying to figure out where it is, like between volume 3 and 4 or Vader, right, or something like that. That can be the tricky part, but at least they do collect it all together, so you, sure, could just read it in, yeah, one sitting.
And when I picked it up, I was like, oh, I'm wondering if this is probably one I should wait to get collected. And I'm gonna say, yeah, I probably won't read anymore. I'll wait to get them collected, because I don't want to struggle with that. Mm-hmm. And I will probably enjoy the story more reading it in a lump.
Yeah.
In a block.
And it's Kieran Gillen doing the writing, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Did I say that?
I don't remember. No. You might have.
No, I think I said that first thing, Nicole.
I know. That's why it's probably gone out of my brain.
I thought you were getting the main Star Wars title.
I am getting the main Star Wars
title. Oh, so you already got three parts down now.
Yeah,
oh,
so all you need is two issues of Aphra.
Okay. I'm sitting on my couch at home. They've been there for weeks. So.
You just need two issues of Aphra.
Oh. Yeah. Look at the trouble I cast in my own world.
No, it's a legitimate thing
Where
to talk
you
about.
Where
you? All right. Well, Star Wars Screaming Citadel. Thank you, Cole.
Screaming Citadel.
Chris Cassell, what do you got for us?
So Heavy Metal is doing a bunch of comic books, not just their normal magazine stuff. And I picked up this trade paperback for The Doorman, and it's one of my favorite things of the year so far. It's written by Elliot Rahal and Daniel Kibblesmith, great name,
yeah,
and drawn by Kendall Good. And basically, it's a profession of people across the universe, and doormen oversee portals that take you from one planet to the other instantaneously. So they're porters. And the doorman of Earth never sees anyone for 40 years of his job, because Earth is like the last place anybody ever wants to visit. And one day, an alien pops out of it unscheduled with a gun and tries to kill the doorman, and a alien cop saves his butt, and she's uncovered a conspiracy to murder all the doormen of every planet, because there's a corrupt super like cabillionaire guy who wants to make flying space casinos, and he wants to get rid of all other forms of transportation. So there's a great concept behind it, and there's a great sense of humor. The characters are well written. The space cop is kind of great, because she's basically the molder of an alien space precinct. She's in the basement, and she's got like the I want to believe kind of posters going around, but she's already an alien.
I want to believe in humans.
Yes. But they have some fun ideas. Like, they go to a planet called Zookopedia, which is the greatest zoological library of natural science and data. And it turns out that all of the denizens of that planet are robots, and they, instead of humans making metal things to do computer stuff, it's the other way around there. The robots make organic things to do their computer stuff. And so, for example, there's a Giraffadex that's part animal, part hard drive, and its DNA contains nearly 10,000 terabytes of the internet's most hardcore pornography. And they need to go to that planet so they can get a little cool koala called the Qualmanic. And it's a living marsupial database genetically encoded with the most proprietary information in the known universe. So it's really silly. a lot of fun, really great artwork, and it's a cool concept. So it's like $9.99 for 6 issues. It's a great introductory price and well worth checking out.
Great. Yeah, sounds like a fun book.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Chris. And finally, Nicole, what do you got for us?
So I read the first 2 issues of Kim Reaper by Sarah Growley. Growley. Okay, Red. Anyway, so she does all the art and everything. There's lettering by Crank! Exclamation point. Anyway, so this follows a girl named Becca. It's by Oni Press. It's very, 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 very cartoony. If you like Boom stuff, if you like Scott Pilgrim-y kind of artwork, this is sort of in vein with that. They're kind of chibi style almost. Follows a girl named Becca. She's a college student. She's got a crush on this girl, Kim, who's like kind of gothy, and she's talking with her friend about like how much she loves her and like, and how like she's goth enough for her and all these things. And then they're come up with this plan, like, but let's have her come to the pub and, you know, I can try to like have her like go on a date with me eventually or something like that. And it's very silly. And then she follows Kim to go after class to invite her out and finds out that she goes through some like super gothy portal and she's got a scythe with her. And Kim is actually a part-time Grim Reaper. There's like a whole council of reapers and she's kind of at the bottom rung. She can only reap animal souls, not human animal souls. So she goes to go get this kitty cat. And the kitty cat lives in a house with this muscle man with like cut off jeans and he has like a bazillion cats and they, things go awry and, she is trying to get the cat from this guy and he's like, this cat is the best cat. This cat is named Chad and he's my prize cat and he drinks and exercises the same as me, therefore making him just as invincible as me. And this cat is like totally ripped and on the verge of death. The first issue is kind of like dealing with that. And then the second issue, just goes into the fact that Kim has like certain abilities where she can portal jump into places. And so they kind of both go to their favorite places and there might be some cute flirting going on and stuff like that too. And there's already like a conflict that shows up in this between the two of them. But it was just super fun. It's super cute how much, Becca is both fearless and also like really smitten with Kim. And they're in the second issue, there's this cute part where she's just like, do you have a boyfriend? Or a girlfriend? Anybody? And tried to find out, like, you know, like, do I got a shot or not? The second issue has tons of cats on it, too, because it rounds up the other one. So there's lots of cute cats on the cover. It's very fun. I would recommend either picking up the single issues or waiting for the trade. It's one of those things that it's lighthearted enough that you could kind of go either way.
Yeah.
It's not very deep one, but it's just really fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Kim Reaper. Thank you, Nicole. And that is Book Report, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And by the Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford. Or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicstension.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Send us quiz time questions, because that's what we're doing. Get your quiz hats on, everybody. This week, the questions come to us from Chris Slade. On us, Chris.
Okay, so since this was our episode about imaginary tales, I called this one, What Else? So a lot of this is going to be instantly gotten because, you know, we just talked about a lot of them. But hopefully there's some learning going on. So first question.
Hopefully some learning.
Consider the first Elseworlds. This special by Brian Augustine and drawn by Mike Mignola featured a Victorian age version of the superhero Batman hunting Jack the Ripper, who had come to Gotham City. The title was not originally published as an Elseworld comic, but its success led to the creation of the imprint, and this title was retroactively declared the first Elseworld story. What was it called?
Gotham by Gaslight.
Bonus. What was the first book to feature the Elseworlds logo?
Gotham by Gaslight.
You did mention it. It's one of your favorites.
One of my favorites. And it was a Batman one.
It was a Batman one.
Okay. Because they were all Batman for a while.
Yeah.
You gave me a sour look. Like,
yeah.
No, cool. I'm sorry. Was it Holy Terror?
Yes.
Okay.
Alternate timeline where Oliver Cromwell lived 10 years longer than he did in our world, and the United States of America is a Commonwealth nation run by a corrupt theocratic government.
Not to be confused with Frank Miller's travesty of the same title.
Yeah. It's good to clarify that.
Don't read that.
Yeah.
This series blended biblical allegories and meta-commentary of the 90s superhero comic books to a realistic painting style. DC would often tease that this was the eventual future of the DCU, slowly incorporating various unique characters from the series into their main universe.
You said all of that.
I did. What was the name of this Prestige 4-issue miniseries?
Kingdom Come.
Yes. Oh. Okay, here's some new lands.
That's okay. Just were we paying attention
doing
time?
Doing a pop quiz on what we just discussed.
Exactly. It's great. It's perfect.
Written learning is happening.
Yes, learning. Written by Chuck Dixon with art by J.H. Williams III, this story involves the Justice League of America recast in assorted roles in the Wild West.
No.
Wonder Woman is a marshal, Booster Gold is a Maverick-style gambler, Wally West is an outlaw wrongly accused of the death of Barry Allen, Ted Kord is an inventor wearing a pair of antennae, Guy Gardner is a Pinkerton detective hunting the Flash, and so on. There is also a cameo at the end by Clark Kent as a dime novel writer. What was this, Elseworlds?
Was it Rough Riders?
No. That's a new series coming out right now.
It's something Riders.
Yes. Starring Riders. Starring what kind of league?
A Justice Riders.
Justice Riders. There you go.
I own this and I couldn't remember the name.
That's okay. I still have it.
Which of these four Batman Elseworlds titles is a fabrication? Batman Houdini, The Devil's Workshop. Batman teams up with Harry Houdini to fight child-stealing vampires in 1907. Batman, The Blue, The Gray, and The Bat features Batman and Robin in American Civil War. Batman, Black Ice. Bruce Wayne's parents are frozen in an experiment that also leaves Bruce unable to survive without a Sub-Zero suit as he becomes Mr. Freeze. Or Batman, Castle of the Bat, where a young Dr. Bruce Wayne attempts to resurrect his father into an avenging Batman to discover who killed his parents.
So, like, most of those are true, is what you're telling
us. Yes, unfortunately, yes.
No, there's a false one.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Well, most
of them are true. Yes. Black Ice is the false one?
Black Ice.
Because, yes, I have all those other crappy ones. And they were really grinding them out. It was like, they... I'm sorry, I don't want to take this
that's
away
okay.
from you.
Yeah. Black Ice is my personal one that I want to
yeah,
have.
Yeah, well, Black Ice
sounds
is good.
A lot more fun than Batman Houdini ever could have been.
Yeah. This film noir homage, written by Ed Brubaker and art by guess who?
What?
Sean Phillips.
Oh, sorry.
Takes place in Gotham City. I'm just making fun. It's always Sean Phillips.
It's always Sean Phillips.
Takes place in Gotham City in the year 1949 and is told through the eyes of James Gordon, written as a hard-boiled alcoholic private detective.
What could it possibly be?
He is caught up in a massive conspiracy involving the corrupt mayor's office and connections to Gotham organized crime when a beautiful young woman turns up dead and Gordon is framed for her murder. What is the name of this one?
Batman Noir.
Close.
Oh.
Where does Batman act work in?
Gotham Noir.
Noir. Noir. Oh, yeah. 2001 predates Criminal.
Noir.
It's just like, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Last one. Set during World War II, this series casts different characters as covert agents fighting against the Axis. Included among them were a trio called the Bat, the Clock, and the Owl. What was this series called?
Cool.
GSA Liberty File?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, okay. I was going to say, we were just talking about this recently.
I like that relief. Oh, I got it. And that is all I got.
Wonderful.
All right.
Thank
what
you.
Else?
That was great.
Well,
what
thank
else?
You, Chris. And that is Quiz Time, and that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.